Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another Wednesday night premiere. What better way to spend your Wednesday evening than with myself and my special guest, Alana Mercer, who's coming on very, very shortly. So I hope you will enjoy our conversation this evening. And without any further ado, I've kept her waiting long enough. So can I bring on to the show, please, Alana Mercer?
Hi, David.
Hello, Alana. Good to see you.
Yes. Lovely to see you.
Well, as I say, it's been a little while since we spoke last. But as is often the way, Alana, you put out some really good content out there, and my job in some ways is trying to condense the substance of what you say, because when it comes to your work, I don't believe there's another person writing who writes in the depth that you do.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
And
you are one of the few people who can condense it and sort of distill the important parts of it. So thanks for doing the work.
Now, believe you me, it's a pleasure. And this is the thing, you know, we've talked a lot, Alana, over the last number of weeks when we've been chatting together about your work into the Cannibal's Pot. Which, to be quite honest, the more time goes on, the more prescient I think that work was. And, you know, although it's 10 years since it was published, Alana, if anything, it's probably more relevant, folks, it's as relevant as in 2021 as it was back in 2011. But I think as time goes on, other people are maybe beginning to see things from sort of with the perspective you were pointing out back then. So what I wanted to do, I'm going to read you out two short excerpts from your own work, Alana. These words will seem very familiar to you. And then I want you to comment. Okay, folks, so this is from Alana's 2011 book. Quote, "In all, no color should be given to the claim that race is not a factor in the incidence of crime in the US and in South Africa. The vulgar individualist will contend that such broad statements about aggregate group characteristics are collectivist, ergo wrong. He would be wrong." That's quote one. And then the second one, just one line. "In short, generalizations about group characteristics are, in aggregate, valid. These do not contradict the imperative to treat, of course, every individual as an individual." Right, Alana, you wrote the words. Really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Tell us what was you thinking?
Well, I have accepted this very important part from my column very often about the tension between aggregate group differences and the social science behind them, and the contradiction that some people find, that there is no contradiction between those truths, those empirical truths, or those axiomatic truths, in fact.
Yeah.
Because this column really is about the tension between, there shouldn't be any tension between, my method of writing and thinking, which is deductive and axiomatic, Charles Murray, who is an empirical social science scientist and a very important one, and I was just saying that this was wonderful. These insights were in my book of 2011 and since have been excerpted in so many columns, and I thought they were so important, and now he has brought them into the forefront. Rather than just sticking to empirical research, he has brought some wonderful insights which absolutely dovetail with those insights of mine. And I think there was quite a lot of controversy when I had written this in 2011 because I come from the libertarian tradition, the Randian tradition, and any statement about the collective is absolutely shunned. And as soon as you make any statement about group characteristics, you are no longer considered what we call a methodological individualist, which I still am. I don't like race as an organizing principle at all. I shy away from that as an individualist, but there's no tension to me between the truth behind these, you know, these aggregate group characteristics and the imperative to treat individuals as individuals. And the larger quote is where I say that generalizations, provided they are substantiated by hard evidence and not hunches, are not incorrect. And science, not only the social science, relies on our ability. How do we generate? This is why we are so confused about COVID, because we can't see these sort of controlled studies whereby we generalize from a properly selective representative sample of the population we wish to examine. So provided we generalize from, you know, to the larger population, observations drawn from a representative sample, and we do that every day, David. People intrinsically, whether they know this or not, they make prudent decisions as to where to invest our most precious resources, our lives. When you decide where you want to live with your family and your where you want to invest, you make these decisions all the time. Now, you're not saying that you're not going to, let's say, Buckhead, Atlanta, which has had a very bad name recently. You're not saying that you won't go there because all the people are bad. What you're saying that you made a calculation based on solid data about where you're going to invest your most precious assets, and that is your life first and your property second. So that you choose not, as I write there, that you choose not to live in a particular crime-riddled county or country in no ways implies that you are considering all the individuals there as criminals, or that you are racist, only that based on, you know, a sensible determination based on statistically significant data, you have made decisions on where you want to invest the most precious resources. So generalizations about groups, as you said, as you quoted, in aggregate are valid, but we must not forget, and that's the point that I made in 2011, that there is an imperative to treat each and every individual as an individual. And this is what Charles Murray was saying very implicitly, very explicitly in his latest book.
I mean, it's incredibly reasonable from my perspective, Alan, what you've written and what Charles Murray in many ways has vindicated as well, insofar as we've heard so much about in COVID times about, you know, evidence-based science. Well, what you wrote back then and what Charles Murray, it is fundamentally taking empirical data, evidence, and then understanding where that leads you. As you say, you can aggregate up whilst accepting that you judge everyone as an individual. I don't see a contradiction there, but some people do seem to feel that there is.
But, you know, later on in the same column where I was so excited that finally these two of these axiomatic underpinnings of my book I've repeated in so many columns, and, you know, they haven't really been alighted on or taken taken anybody's fancy. But now that Charles Murray has brought this into light, I was so thrilled and happy, as you say, to be vindicated. But I generally am not an empiricist at all. I think I reason very closely, and I base my writing on analytical truth and axiomatic truth. And so one of my editors at Town Hall, very smart young lady, said to me when I wrote systemic racism or systemic rubbish, I used purely analytical deductive thinking. And she said to me, well, Ilana, and she's completely right, she said to me, where is your evidence for saying, you know, that the way we infer systemic racism is by reasoning backwards? You know, we say if underrepresented in the economy, in the profession, so on and so forth, then racism. And I was reasoning deductively, And she said, where is the evidence for this? And she was uncomfortable with this. And then after explaining my reasoning to her in the column, and I think systemic racism or systemic rubbish explains it very well. You know, I said to her that I wrote in that column, equalizing individual and intergroup outcomes is an impossibility, considering that it is axiomatically and self-evidently true to say that such differences have existed since the dawn of time. Yeah. So this obsession, and this is about COVID as well, and I'm going to write this, I've been, you know, keeping this back because I know that people are on each side of the, on the right and the left, are going on about science. But what comes before science is thinking, and the ancients thought of a philosophy of science. And if you think clearly, that presages science, and that's how it's supposed to work. And it's certainly not working when you rely entirely on the empirical method, which is not the way of the Misesians. The Misesians, who come out of the Aristotle school of thought. Not to get too bogged down in abstractions.
No, I think the other thing I thought I really enjoyed in what you were saying in that column, Alana, was that you know, you talk about the fact that people do, the word discrimination has been taken and warped out of all context in a way which is very unhelpful, I think, for us as a society. So, you know, as you say in it here, you do make the point that, I mean, discrimination is one word, but I mean, we could use alternative words, couldn't we, that mean exactly the same thing?
Leading into another argument, which is it's another complicated dispute that we have in the libertarian community, and that is, you will notice that our favorite broadcaster Tucker Carlson always ends the discussion, and this is what it has been among economists and libertarians, and this is what I hammered out in the book Into the Cannibal's Pot, and kept repeating in subsequent columns because this was so important to me, but nobody has really alighted on it. And I'm so wonderfully relieved that Charles Murray has brought this out now, is that there is a half-truth to speaking about a market economy. So you'll have Tucker Carlson speak beautifully about our merit-based American society and say that he wants a merit-based society and that will sort everything out. But as I say in Cannibal and repeated in this column that you're highlighting, to say, you know, to say that a merit-based society and a free market economy will sort everything out because it's fair is only to divulge a half-truth, because there is another truth to it. And, you know, and we conservatives and libertarians, we don't like affirmative action, set-asides, or quotas, because we love the free market and we love the merit-based institutions. But what we are not telling when we say it's marvelously redeeming when you say I like merit, I like everybody based on their individual abilities, but there is another side, and this is where group characteristics plays into it, and group and facts about the aggregate propensities in different groups, in achievement, in athleticism, in inhibition control. The market is oriented towards productivity. And indeed, if we don't have any of these state interventions or corporate interventions, recently the corporations are even stricter than government in enforcing quotas and set-asides and not being colorblind about talent. But yes, the market is blind, and when you buy something nice, you don't care who made it and who brought it to market. But it is also true, and this is where the half-truth issue comes into play, that the market is oriented towards productivity. And ultimately, because you're paying for your outlay as a capitalist, as you know, you are going to hire and promote by productivity. And productivity once again displays the group differences that we spoke about. So a merit-based society is not a society in which you can get over the difficulty of different groups being differently represented in our economy. And this is what I said in Cannibal and in many columns subsequent. In other words, what the good economists and the good conservatives are loath to let on is that a free market is a market in which groups and individuals are differently represented. And parity in prosperity and performance can be achieved only by playing socialist leveler. The state must play a role as a socialist leveler. So Murray once again reiterates, or at least validates, that was a good word you used, validates that point exactly to my delight. And he says here in his latest book, he says, refusing to confront race differences in means leads in a straight line to thinking that the only legitimate evidence of a non-racist society is equal outcomes. The logical conclusion is that the state must force equal outcomes by whatever means necessary. I'll be so humble and say that I was a little bit more artful. I like parity and prosperity and performance can be achieved only by playing socialist leveler. But he's a guy, and my prose is fabulous.
As I said, Alana, you know, the logical, as Murray writes, the logical conclusion is that the state must therefore force outcomes by whatever means necessary, and that can include force. So herein lies the great danger, doesn't it?
Well, exactly, and this is. You know, this is where we are, in that we are at a place where affirmative action and set asides and quotas are just a fact of the economy, and certainly with a vengeance, a fact of corporate society. I don't know how much it's the case in Britain, but in the US, it's the only reason I think that corporations, our large corporations, the deep tech, do so well is because, you know, as we compared them in previous broadcasts to a sort of a oil state, such as the it is such a behemoth. Yeah. The revenues are such, and it comes from top down, so that they can afford to create political fiefdoms and dole out money based on things other than productivity, because there's so much money in the system, there's so much give in the system. And the other issue is that, how to put it diplomatically, certain sectors of high tech carry the load. So in other words, you will put forward the appealing faces that you want to portray, the political front people and front men and women, but behind the scenes, you will have almost cognitive indenture, a sort of slavery, cognitive slavery. And this is another point made into the Cannibals part, that's how South African society works. South Africans can get to very high positions with 12 years of subpar education, but behind the scenes, someone is toiling to enable the company to continue churning and to continue being somewhat productive.
See, I think that actually, Alana, that's very true of, as you say, of deep tech. I mean, I imagine when it comes to, say, a platform I particularly deplore, Twitter, I would imagine there are obviously talented people working within it. You'd be foolish to think otherwise. But I think those people in Silicon Valley, some of them sitting down there in Twitter HQ, with their Captain Marvel hairstyles and their ever so PC views, they contribute nothing of value whatsoever. And they are being completely carried by, as you rightly observe, others.
Well, I don't know whether the head honchos have any technical abilities, but what I'm trying to say is that when deep tech promotes certain front people, let's say the obsession with female engineers. I mean, if you go on websites specifically dedicated by female engineers to female engineers, females in Microsoft, you will see that they speak more about being a female engineer than about the products. And if you go on male sites, you will say you will see the delight in making the products. And I live with someone who does that, and I can see that females in engineering, what's that? I want to know how you make a surface work, you know, how you get a great antenna. So there's a difference between the people they push to the front, the males, the people of color, the minorities. And of course, there are wonderful people among them, because we're speaking about treating individuals as individuals.
Key point,
But they can do that because Twitter and Microsoft and Apple are such behemoths. I mean, their economies are what? I mean, the economies are of a couple of
they would fit into the G7 quite easily, exactly, I would imagine.
Exactly, that's a good analogy, precisely. But there's a lot of give in the system for this political play.
Yes, but the reason for that is because there's an avoidance of the realities that you rightly highlight in the first place, Alana, that there are, and as Charles Murray has reinforced, we mustn't shy away from certain realities just because some people mightn't like them. And at the same time, and you're very, you know, I notice you're very particular to point this out, and I completely agree that we should treat, of course, everyone as individuals. That's how we operate. We're not the collectivists. But by the same token, we shouldn't ignore the fact that there are these collectivists, these group aggregate characteristics, which can be very, very significant. So I think, I mean, I love talking to you so much, Alana. You don't shy away from going to the core, and okay, perhaps it's your way of your deductive reasoning, but you get to the core of the issue, even if that core makes some people feel a little bit uncomfortable. I think it's fundamental, because if you don't go to where you go, then you do end up with essentially diversity hires and the rest of it, which is then completely destructive of society, economies, and even those individuals.
And even more so, and as Murray says in his latest book, he says, unless we can speak honestly, and that's what I say in this column, systemic racism or systemic rubbish, unless we can acknowledge and stand our grounds, to use a term from gun rights, standing our grounds, unless we can stand our grounds on the social science and the analytical truth behind the truth of aggregate differences, we have no argument against systemic racism. Yeah, we just have no argument. Right. We have no leg to stand on. I mean, because systemic racism is inferred from a lack of equal representation in the economy and in the professions. And unless we can argue that, you know, systemic racism is not a consequence, a single cause consequence. And also that's my position deductively. And also fortify with the empirical evidence, we have to accept systemic racism, David.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, yeah. Alana. I think, you know, in many regards, this is where I know I've said it before, but I think your experience in South Africa is massively relevant to the US, but as I keep saying to you, also here in the UK, because we have exactly, there's the same avoidance of realities, unfortunately, here as well. You know, you mentioned...
Are you as bad as us? My husband has imported some incredible talent from England, and we were assured that it wasn't as bad as the American corporations as yet was being influenced.
I think, unfortunately, as we've said before as well, America has such a, it casts such a shadow around the world that countries like the UK inevitably get caught up, especially as in Atlanta, with the big multinationals. They essentially have the same kind of regimes in both sides of the Atlantic. So, you know, so we unfortunately are very much going down there at the moment. I mean, we just can't have enough women. Women are everywhere. Just before, I mean, the moment we've got a big football competition on here in the, well, in Europe, the Euros 2020. But they're
David,
being played in 20.
If you have the choice of watching the 100 meter dash male or female, Otto Bolt, or I don't know who the females are, you know,
yeah,
I love track and field. I'm not so much into the games, but. Yeah. Who are you going to watch? Who are you going to watch? That the male 100-meter dash to me is the highlight of everything.
Oh, yeah. Listen, we could go on about this one forever. At the moment, every football match has got female footballers commentating. They're in the studio expounding their wisdom. They've never played in front of more than about 10 people, I reckon, most of them. And yet, it's the fact that it's all about we've got to make sure we have the requisite number of people of color, of women, of LGBT community plus, blah, 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 blah. And I think that is fundamentally, it's not right. That's the wrong way of approaching it. And that's why, you know, if you want to treat people as individuals, then you should surely make sure that you employ the best people, regardless of some of these other attributes. But that's not what's happening, Alana. That is not what's happening. Diversity hire is everything. And we are pretending that there are, for example, no group aggregates, which are common. You're pretending that there's not. You rightly have pointed out, you know, as I say, you must have some sense of vindication because you pointed it out quite a long time ago. And yet, bang, there we have further vindication for what you've written, Alana, because the thing is, some truths, in fact, truth tends to remain consistent. It was right in 2011. It's right in 2021. It's going to be right in 2031. And so I'm very grateful that you bring these issues up and speak them in your eloquent way, Alana. It makes a great contribution, I think, you know, and that's what I was so pleased when I read this column and I could see that Charles Murray was fundamentally, from his own perspectives, arriving with the same things that you had said. But there are things that unfortunately, Alana, that's why we have this platform and we want to get these views out here because these will not be commonly said on, even Fox with Tucker Carlson. You won't get them. You won't get them said.
No. You will end at his laudable praise of a merit-based society. I'm for a merit-based society, but that's a half-truth. In a merit-based society, people, especially groups, are markedly underrepresented or differently represented. So, in fact, you will have Asians being represented more in certain spheres than Caucasians.
Yeah.
And you will have, in aggregate, African-Americans being fewer on a merit-based society. But that's the half-truth. That's the other part of the truth that they don't tell us. And to get back to the end of my column where I say that disarmed of the firearm of truth, analytical and empirical, without standing our ground on the immutable truths of aggregate groups, group differences, while we take care to treat each and every individual on their merit, we conservatives are rendered intellectually defenseless. We have no argument unless we stand on the axiomatic and shall I say historic, because it goes back to
forever,
to ancient, you know, time immemorial, and the empirical truth of those differences.
Yeah, well, we can't afford to be disarmed intellectually or indeed in any other way, I have to say, Alana. And when it comes to half-truths, the great thing about you is that you give us the whole truth. So for that, I think everyone will be very appreciative. So, Alana, we have come to the end of our time. We've got to the end of the show. But as always, I want to thank you very much for giving us your time to talk about these really important issues that just deserve to be much better aired. So thank you, Alana. Thanks, everybody, for watching. And we will be back to see you real soon. That's it from us, everyone. Good night.